Cynthia. Let's just go for main engine start.
Go at throttle up. Negative return. Then we see a nominal Miko. Welcome to space.
If you got Always Sunny in Philadelphia references, I would have a funny joke to make right now.
I have not watched that show.
Bummer. That's a bummer.
I feel like I need to, but I just haven't got to it.
It was the way when I moved to Florida that I felt like I was still home. As batshit crazy as it is.
I like your closet.
Yeah, why do I feel like you're already recording this? I guess I should hit record anyway. So I've made a lifestyle upgrade in my iPhone 10 and a lifestyle downgrade that now I sit in a closet for like an hour and a half to 2 hours every week.
Did you have to sell your office to afford the iPhone? Is that what it was?
No, I just, you know what? It's the wood floors in the office are just like a little too echoey. So yeah, it just doesn't work out.
Yeah, this room's pretty good because it's got carpets and there's enough furniture in it that it,
yeah,
you know,
you get some dampening somehow.
Yeah.
So the sad part is that I'm now thinking about like making the, rather than hanging, as you can see, various hoodies around. So like I've got, this is a coat rack bar. There is also one here above a bunch of shelves. So the computer that you're looking at is sitting on a shelf with various hoodies hung around it in sound dampening arrangement. Because we are independent podcasters and that's what we do.
Yeah.
But I suppose I could just buy like sound insulation for like $10 on Amazon and just nail it to the wall in front of me and behind me.
Yeah, probably.
And it would sound pretty good.
Yeah.
So I think I'm going to do that to just make it a little easier in here and then make like one of these shelves a permanent thing. Because if I can get a shot that's like doesn't have this in it, I could do this when I call someone that isn't you and not be like, are you, where are you?
Do you need money?
So, yeah, right. Yeah, it's like, I see your Patreon is doing okay, but like, yeah. I should get my beer. I also don't have a table in here, so I don't really have any place to put things.
Okay, well, what are you drinking?
I've got myself. I did go with the Victory again. I was debating, but got a Victory Hop Devil IPA here. This is like one of the best ones. That it's probably their best beer, I think. Like, personally, I think that, and everybody else also thinks that.
Okay.
So, I don't know. Pretty badass label as well.
Are you getting a secret sponsorship from Victory that I don't know about?
No, I just tend to get them a lot. So.
Oh, okay.
They're local, so they're always cheap.
Yeah.
And delicious.
Okay.
So
okay.
This is one of the two like Philadelphia breweries. Victory and Yards is the other big one. And then we've got Dogfish Head down in Delaware. So there's kind of like the trifecta of local. There's a couple other good ones. What's it like? Tired Hands out a little west of us. So there's some good ones around, but Victory is the one I tend to like because the store right across the street's got like variety packs. So you can get like two of three of four different kinds of beers, and it like rotates throughout the year.
I love those variety packs. They're the best.
Because it's always like reliably good stuff, but it changes enough that you don't get bored.
So. Except that I always find when I buy one of those like variety packs, there's like, you know, there's like four types of beers and like three of them I'm in love with. And one of them's like, this is like banana. And you're like, don't ever make this ever.
Yeah, it's like the bottom of the Halloween bag. Like the stuff that nobody wants to drink.
Exactly. It's like we made a few batches of this and it did not go well. And we need to clear it out. Yeah, I think I had like I literally think it was like a banana Hefeweizen or whatever.
Is it like a banana accidentally fell in and they were like, well, I guess let's go with it.
Maybe. It might be, yeah. Or like 14 bananas maybe. But it just wasn't, like it wasn't good.
It doesn't sound good.
No. I like some fruit stuff in beer. Like I'll accept, obviously, pumpkin I like. But I've even had like some local.
Is that a fruit?
I don't know. But like I've had some like local, there's a place in Edmonton that did this and they put like blueberries or like raspberries in the beer. Like you buy like a pitcher and they're like floating inside of it. Huh. Yeah. And it was pretty good. I'll tolerate that. But like bananas, man, I don't know. And there's all those like banana bread beers that I'm just like, no.
I have not even heard of that, no. But I'm not into that. What do you got over there?
Okay, so I have, this is from a brewery called Mill Street. So this is in Toronto. This is not a Vancouver beer, but still Canadian. Mill Street's really cool. It's like in, it's kind of east of the downtown, right on the waterfront in this like distillery district. And they have like a, it's like an old brick building. It's really, really cool looking. And they do, they're kind of famous for their organic beers. But this one's called 100th Meridian. And if you know...
I get it.
Yeah, you get it. so 100th Meridian being the kind of the longitude where the prairies start in Canada. So all the malt and all the hops and all that stuff is all sourced west of the 100th Meridian. But I picked it because last month there was a very high profile death in Canada. Gord Downie from The Tragically Hip, and it struck me pretty deeply. I don't know if you were following my Twitter feed.
I was like gonna send you flowers or something, but
yeah, the flower shops were kind of out of flowers around here at that time. It's a big deal for Canada. He's a rock star, he's a musician, he's a singer, and he's considered Canada's poet laureate, unofficial poet laureate, because he was just like unabashedly Canadian. Tragically Hip are a big deal, so they had a song called 100th Meridian. So I picked the beer.
Oh, look at that.
For that.
Man, that's really topical. I got to get like on my, I got to match up like events, local events to beers. That's pretty good.
But I'm going to have.
I guess when I say local, it's like half a continent we're talking about here, but yeah. Whatever.
So I've got two here because one's for me and one's for Gord. So this is for you, buddy.
Oh, man, you got to put some music over that part.
We'll fade out with it.
Yeah. All right. Good. Okay. I like that. Sweet.
Yeah. So this is, if they don't know, this is an amber lager. So really quite good. It's a little bit hoppy, but not too bad. Yeah.
Should we get into space stuff?
Space stuff. What are you looking at this month?
Well, I feel like last month we ventured out into new realms, but only just. It was like kind of still within our realm.
I thought that too, because we were like, if you want something different, and we're like,
yeah,
we're
and then it was the same topic. It's like the stuff we just recently covered.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But this is not that. I think we are going way off the beaten path here.
We're gonna try. Yeah, we're gonna try.
Where do you want to start? Gravity waves or interstellar rocks?
Gravitational waves.
Gravitational waves, sorry. Yeah. Gravity waves are a totally different thing.
They're just clouds.
Yeah.
I think. I'm not a meteorologist. Gravitational waves. This is a big deal. And actually, so the one thing we're gonna do with my new mixer is I have this sound queued up.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we're gonna play that. But maybe I'll just walk through. So what happened was two neutron stars crashed. So I guess it's like they fall into like a spinning orbit and they get closer and closer together because their gravity's super intense, and then they collide and it creates gravitational waves, and we measured it. So it was the same, I don't know, like, did you follow it last year when they first discovered
the LIGO, first right? official announcement of the discovery. And then like days before this neutron star thing, there was a fourth gravitational wave observation, which was the first one with all three of the ground-based observatories picking it up.
Oh, I didn't even see that.
Yeah, like, so I forget when the exact announcements were, but on August 14th, there was a black hole merger that, so we've got two LIGO, LIGO observatories is like ATM machines, but we've got two LIGO installations here in the U.S., one out in Washington State, one down in Louisiana. A third observatory opened up over in Italy, just outside Pisa, and they started observing on August 1st. And then August 14th, they picked up a black hole merger. And then August 17th was this neutron star merger.
Wow.
So the 14th was the first observation with all three running, which allowed them to be much more accurate in knowing which way it came from.
Right, right.
Which was big to prove that out before we had this neutron star merger.
That's the same thing that happened last year, because when they like the first one they discovered, they're like, they were spinning up the instrument. They're like, okay, we think everything's working. Let's take it for a test run. They like flipped it on. It was like, boom, gravitational wave.
Yeah, totally.
It was like crazy timing, right?
Which is kind of like, if you were following way back in the day, like I was not following because I was like six or whatever, when LIGO started, they had a lot of issues discovering anything. They ran it for, I guess it was 2000s when they ran it from like 2002 to 2010, I think it was, and they didn't get anything. And then they took it offline and they upgraded the sensitivity quite a bit, put it back online, and that's when we found the first one. So
right, yeah.
For somebody who went through like 8 years of nothing and then to flip it on and be like, okay, somebody's messing with me here. This could not have possibly happened as quick as this did.
Yeah. I know they were like so incredulous. They're like, no, got to mail like 100 people the paper and make sure that you're not crazy, right?
Tell us about this one.
Well, so you were just reminding me that the detector and how super fine and sensitive it is.
Oh my
gosh.
You
were texting me earlier about it too. Because it's interesting the story, but when they build it, right? Because it's like this L shape, and you fire a laser down one side, and then it comes back, and then the time it takes to go one side to the other, there's a little change because of the gravitational wave, and they can measure that. But it's like super fine, so you have to.
Yeah, when you say little.
Yeah, like very little, because they had to start like backing things out, right? Like, okay, we'll turn it on. Oh, we heard a truck down the street, close the door, so we gotta back that out. And it's like, then you get finer and finer, then it's like, oh yeah, someone, you know, lit a cigarette in Croatia, so we gotta turn it down there, because it got down, what was the measurement you told me it was
less than, well, the Caltech site that has facts says it was less than 1/10,000th of a proton, the width of a proton, over a 4-kilometer distance, which I also read on their site was, to equate that, it is like measuring the distance between here and the closest star 4 light years away down to the width of a human hair. So 23.5 trillion miles. Accurate to the width of a human hair.
That's crazy.
You can't even comprehend that.
I don't even know how they back that stuff up. Like, there is a, it reminds me.
How do you
me,
measure it? How do you know that that's the measurement?
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know.
It reminds me, so the NASA InSight mission that's launching, they have the seismometer, you know, the one that messed up and delayed the launch window. They were testing
yeah,
that.
Yeah, let's talk about more stuff that's outside of our realm.
Yeah, but it just reminds me, because the seismometer, they were testing it, and they, you know, it's in Denver. They were testing it, I think at UC Boulder or whatever. And they were turning it on and they were like, what is this wave pattern they're seeing? And they traced it and triangulated it and figured out that they were measuring the waves in California coming up against the shore all the way in Denver, like across the Rockies. So like, that's just like, you know, a Discovery class NASA mission. And this is crazy. That's already
it's
high level. And this is orders and orders of magnitude more sensitive, right?
Wow. That's crazy. Yeah. Anyway, tell us about these neutron stars.
Neutron stars are nuts.
Yeah, let's get into more crazy measurements.
Yeah, and you know what? I didn't even write this stuff down, but I remember I was reading up on it. Basically, like, you know, a star collapses and it's not quite dense enough to be a black hole, so it goes to this neutron star status, and the conservation of angular momentum, because it gets smaller, it has to spin faster. It's the whole figure skater thing, right?
Yep.
So the like rotational speed of these things is like millions of times a second, right? Like, it hits like a fraction of light speed on the surface. It's like spinning so fast. So like,
they're only like 6 miles across, or
yeah,
10 miles across.
They're tiny. Yeah. It's like a million suns in the space of like, you know, a Ford Explorer,
a city,
or something like that. But so two of them get closer and closer together. I guess it was 130 million years ago, which would tell us it was 130 million light years from here, and they collided, and yeah, so then basically what happened is that I'm trying to remember now, it was like the first instrument measured it, and then they sent up like the bat signal, basically, like, this is the cool part of the story, because they sent up the bat signal like, hey, we think we see two neutron stars. And there's all these like great Twitter feed like snapshots of people's like phones are like texting each other like, hey, two neutron stars, and they're like, yeah, I know, you're shitting me, it's not real, don't tell me a joke, I'm at Disneyland with my family, don't tell me that right now. And they're like, no, it's not a joke, But I guess there's like, you know, all these different observatories, like 70 different telescopes all of a sudden like turned to spin to this place. And Fermi was already up there, so it was pointing at the right spot. And all in all, they get like all these measurements. So like the, and this is kind of the cool part about gravitational wave astronomy, which is like a whole new field now, is that they can do this multimodal, what do they call it? Multi-measurement. So they can measure something in an astronomical sense by more than just light. So now they have waves and they have light, and you can cross-reference them, and it just like super solidifies the science. So they draw up all the measurements and they write this paper, and this is crazy. So they have this, they had so many papers come out on it. It was like, I don't know, like 100 papers or whatever. And they had to like make like a mega paper to like explain all the other sub papers. And this mega paper was 45 pages long, and it had 35 pages of authors on it. So it was like 3,500 people had contributed to this mega paper. It was like, that someone estimated it was like 15% of every astronomer that was in on this. So yeah, it's like, it's crazy. Such a cool story. And it's like all the way across the globe, everyone's just like, oh, we got a thing. Everyone turn telescopes right here, right now. And then they, you know, gather all the data and then they piece it together, which is just, I don't know, it's a really cool story. So, that's it.
I really like that aspect, because as somebody who spends most of their day on the internet, like that was the purpose of the internet.
Yeah.
When it was originally envisioned, this was like, hey, what if we connected these people that were working on stuff so we didn't duplicate work and we could share what we're working on and all that. Like that was the original intention. And we eventually turned it into other things as well. But like to see it happen again on that scale, where like that is not possible in an era where we're not all connected like this. So that single instance, I mean, 15% of an industry is like, I don't know, it's a crazy, crazy thing that we can pull off. And that's like, that is the cool part, to have these three different observatories that are focused on this kind of thing around the globe. And we have three, so we can do a better job at like triangulating where it's coming from and then focusing all of our attention there. There are just so many parts that it's like everything came together in this perfect way, that like these waves have been traveling for 130 million years, got here by the time we got our shit together.
Yeah, it's kind of, if you think of it from that direction, where it's like, you know, if someone was like stepping back and watching the whole process over 130 million years, they're like, boom, we just crashed two neutron stars. And they like, you watch it. And then like just at the last fraction of a second, we like,
yep, totally,
humans appear and discover astronomy and then build the right instrument and look at it. Right?
So yeah, you would be getting like nervous in the 90s.
Yeah.
As like LIGO wasn't going so well. We couldn't build it. Then we finally got it built. They didn't find anything in 2000s. Like, oh, geez, we only got like 10 years left. Do you think they're going to make it in time?
Yeah.
It reminds me a lot of the Grand Tour, in that like, that, what's that, once every 176 years, I think it was.
That sounds right. Yeah.
That one always screws with me, because like, obviously, alternate history is always like a funny thing to get into, but like, if World War II didn't happen to trigger rocketry, to trigger the space race at the exact moment that we would have the skills necessary to send the Grand Tours out, at that moment, we would have had to wait like 200 years.
Yeah.
To pull it off again.
Yeah, we would. And we
it's
wouldn't
like that,
have
that timing. That's
we
just
wouldn't
crazy.
Have visited Neptune or Uranus today.
Yeah, we wouldn't even know.
Yeah.
So I love that. Now, obviously, these things are probably more common than that, but...
Yeah, you know. And that's when I start to wonder. It's just like, every time, this is now twice, we just like fire up an instrument and discover one right away. So maybe they're actually a lot more common than we think, and we're just...
Yeah, because this ran, they turned on Virgo in Italy on August 1st. They took it down at the end of August, and we found all this stuff during that month. Now they're taking it offline to upgrade the sensitivity and make it even better for when they fire it up the end of next year. So, like, you know, the fraction of time that this has been running versus the time that it has been worked on is pretty crazy to know that it's already found something so big.
So we have the sound. So this is...
Oh, yeah. I forgot about the sound.
Yeah. So this is the sound of the two stars. It's not the real sound. They, like, map the frequency of the waves.
Were you there? Do you know? Like, you don't know.
I was not there. No, I was.
As far as I know, this is the real sound.
I had a dentist appointment, but okay. So we're going to try my new mixer. I think I have it set up right. I'm just going to bring it through on my channel. So I'm going to mute myself. And
the best part is, if you screw this up, you can just edit it in and nobody will know. They think you'll pull it off.
No one will know. Yeah. They're like, okay, here we go.
imagining it in my head. But
it was so good in your head, right?
It is. No, yeah. I mean, when I heard that, I like sent that or put that in our little notes as soon as I could because that's the best sound I've ever heard.
Yeah, it's pretty
funny. It's so satisfying. It's like, it's perfect.
Yeah, it's good. And it has the slow build up. You're just like, is this a static? And you're like, oh.
I showed it to my wife earlier when I was going through the notes for this. And it was like, what, a 30-second clip or something?
Yeah.
And the first 20, it's just like static. Yeah. She's like, oh, wow, that sounds pretty cool. And I was like, it hasn't happened yet. And she's like, oh, okay. Good, because that was kind of boring.
You're like, okay, sweetie.
You got anything else in this?
I don't think so. That's the big story. So, I mean, I imagine we're going to hear lots more cool stuff from gravitational waves. So very exciting that we have this this new form of science.
That's maybe one part that we didn't really talk about, is that it's not like we changed the game in terms of being able to observe gravitational waves.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just like we put up a new kind of telescope that looks in a different part of the visible lights or the light spectrum or anything like that. Like, or even got like bigger aperture so we can see, you know, farther out and all that crap. Like, this is a new thing. It's an entirely new thing that is like a third dimension almost.
Yeah.
And then it allows us to, you know, like this event happened that we could see gravitational waves for. And then they told everybody, hey, use your visible light and your X-rays and all of your other kind of telescopes and aim them over there so we could see the other end of this and get the whole story. So it's like adding so much detail to stuff that we've already been observing for so long that it's going to change the way that you look at, you know, things that are outside of our galaxy or outside of, you know, our solar system or anything like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like when, you know, when we transition from looking at planets through telescopes to sending spacecraft there, right? Like, it's just like a whole new way to, it's like ground truthing, right? That's what same thing with geology, is that you can take a picture of an orbit, but then when you go there and your ground measurement matches up to the orbital measurement, and then you've ground truthed it, and like the two sciences work together to make like a sum that's greater than their two parts, right?
Yeah, and it makes both sides better, and then you keep pushing on, and it's fantastic.
Science!
So like on that end though, like you were talking about with Mars InSight, that doing that for Mars at the level, like you're saying, they're picking up waves in California from Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like InSight is going to be pretty amazing when it gets there, if everything goes well and works out. Like, the stuff that we will see with that is something that we've kind of observed a little bit at Mars, and we hypothesize because of what we know about Mars, but like, it's going to be pretty huge to learn about. You know, you can talk to this better than I can, obviously, but the amount of stuff that we're going to be able to both like learn from the mission, but then apply what we learned from that mission to the stuff that we've got from every other mission that has went to Mars. It's a multiplier, you know, in that way, which is awesome.
Well, that's the whole strategy behind the Mars program, right? It's like, let's send a bunch of spacecraft.
We have a strategy behind that right now? Oh, geez. Too soon?
Ouch. It hurts.
All right. Next crazy story.
What do you want
to
touch
on? We've got a visitor.
A visitor?
This one's fun.
What do you call it? Do you call it an exo-asteroid, or... I've seen some other fun terms for it too.
I don't know. Like, what do we call it? We don't know.
I mean, we call it whatever we want.
Terms are terms, right? Like, interstellar rock sounds pretty cool because it sounds like a genre that I would listen to
interstellar as well.
Like, can we make that as well? Can we make that genre? Maybe we could do the space podcaster band that we're talking about. Maybe that can be the name.
What would be the name of the band that really pioneers interstellar rock?
I'm thinking maybe that should just be the name, and we just pull a Kleenex on interstellar rock. Like, maybe we would have another name, but by the time that we're done, everyone would just call us interstellar rock.
Okay, I like it. Yeah.
Anyway,
that's okay, that's bold.
So
bold,
what do
idea.
You call this thing?
So I think the coolest sounding name I saw was Xeno Asteroid. I don't even know what Xeno means, but it's got an X in it.
It sounds great, yeah.
It's bonus points in my book. But yeah, so this is a 400-meter rock that seems to have come from somewhere in the direction of the Lyra constellation. And it came clipping in at 26 kilometers per second, which is pretty fast.
And now it's picked up a bunch of speed, right? Like, the thing I saw was now it's leaving at 44, or it's currently traveling at 44.
Well, I didn't read that. That's really fast.
I mean, by the time it gets out of the solar system, it'll slow down quite a bit. But
yeah.
I think it was going 44 kilometers a second as it whipped around the sun.
Jeez. Okay, yeah.
The really sad part is that we didn't, obviously because of where Earth is, we didn't discover this until it passed closest approach. So this came in, yeah. It entered the solar system September?
So it came, before that. So it came from like above the solar system. So if you think of the solar system as a flat disk where all the planets orbit, it came from like the top and it was behind the sun from our vantage point, and it passed through the ecliptic like early September 2nd or so, inside the orbit of Mercury, and then whipped underneath the sun and then under us, like it was closest pass was like 24 million kilometers. And then a few days after it passed by us, we saw it. So that's kind of the timeline, which is like mid-October.
And there was some, like, people were not super confident that it was interstellar. You and I were, like, texting. We're like, is this thing interstellar? I don't know. There were some people saying, like, there was one crappy observation of this thing. And if you take that out, it doesn't look interstellar. Since then, the University of Hawaii Institute for Astronomy, I think that's what it's called.
IFA, yeah.
They've like said, nope, this is interstellar. We've tracked it. This was tracked out of Hawaii, the Pan-STARRS 1 telescope, I think it was. They've said like, no, this thing is interstellar. We know for sure.
Yeah, because when they first announced it, they only had like 6 days of observation or something. So it's like, it's just not enough sample of the orbit to like give it enough confidence interval. But every day that goes by and they keep observing it, then they get better and better, right? But yeah, so Pan-STARRS 1, which is at Haleakala Observatory, which is
I was staying away from that.
I wanted to say it because I had to learn how to say it because I got to go there last year. Not to the, like, you can't go in, but I went to the top. There's like a national park up there. It's like awesome looking place. So I got to see that observatory, and so when I read about it, I was like, hey, I've been there. Haleakala, I think I got that right. For the all the Hawaiian listeners, please write in and tell me how bad I did on that. There's got to be one, right? Someone up there.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah. NASA's press release thing about this was a little less like concretely worded. They were obviously, it's NASA, so they tend to do that in general because politics. But they I don't know if that means that they're like not super confident in it yet, or they just are writing it that way because obviously, like, you know, something could always happen. It could have, like, I don't know.
Yeah.
There's always something, I guess, is their reasoning for it.
Well, I mean, I think technically we haven't had like an official paper written on it because like it was like a week ago, right? So
right, yeah, exactly.
If you're doing good science, like this hasn't gone through peer review yet, so like we should be more skeptical,
right?
It looks good, so it's, I mean, it looks like we're gonna get there. It's just the details at this point, but I guess if you're NASA, you want to do it right. So it's a potential interstellar visitor.
I like that they were still like, oh shit, how do we name this? Like,
yeah.
This doesn't fit in our current naming scheme, and they had to come up with something new.
It's already changed names based once, on our right?
system. Yeah, right. It's already got a formally known as kind of thing.
It was like Comet, and then they're like, no, it's an asteroid, which I still, like, I've read that difference about 114 million times, and I still don't know the difference between an asteroid and a comet as much as I try, other than I think the orbits are different. That's about all I can really guess. But
yeah, that's why I was struggling with like calling it an exo-asteroid, because I'm like, I don't know, man, we've changed the names like 6 times of stuff in the solar system that we've been looking at for like 100 years.
Yeah.
Maybe this is a good time to like come up with something new entirely.
Maybe, yeah.
You know?
And if we give it a couple decades, it might just be a planet for all we know, right? That one's pretty fluid, so.
Yeah. You got anything else like hard sciencey about this? Because I've got a very strange direction to take this one.
All I know is that, they did a spectro analysis or whatever, and they think it might be a little bit red, which is, I guess, typical for most of the Kuiper Belt objects that we see. So think like Pluto red, I guess. And they may know that it's a pretty slow rotating one. So like rotation, like a day on this asteroid, something like 6.5 Earth days or so. That's some of the tweets I saw on it. But other than that, yeah, we don't know enough yet. Like I said, we need the paper, right?
It's just so fun to think about everything that's like rogue planets and stuff floating through nothing. Like,
yeah.
It is so cool to think about how much stuff there is that is just in the void and like flying, hauling ass at some other system. It's so cool to think about. Because, like, there's, you know, our solar system has probably sent some of that stuff out.
Yeah. And actually, I read something about that, and that was how they were modeling this. They were just like, well, how much of the original crap from our solar system is still here? And they were like,
it's gone or something. Yeah.
None of it. It's none of it's here. This is like 1% of what was here. It's all out there. So if they presume every other star did the same thing, then there's just like, yeah, it's like a shooting range out here.
It's kind of awesome. And that's, so this is, I'll walk you in slowly to my crazy end of what I'm talking about here. But, so like, this is a really cool way to, we know that this came from something vaguely solar system like.
Yeah.
In that, like, it's a rock and it got launched by something. Like, this was orbiting a star somewhere at some point.
Yeah.
And got blasted out. So it's a good way to, like, track back, you know, from this to another system, which is kind of cool in itself. That it, like, this points, you know, if you can figure out all the trajectory stuff, this points to a system, not just, like, you know, we look for exoplanets and then we sometimes like shoot a Voyager and just hope for the best. But like this points us in a direction of a system, which is kind of awesome in its own right. So then I was thinking, okay, if you were a sufficiently advanced species and you were trying to send messages out that like we're here, shooting a Voyager is pretty good. But if you were to hypothetically attach something much smaller that is easier to accelerate to a rock that is 400 meters and is big enough to be picked up by telescopes of another sufficiently advanced species, like that could be a good strategy to either one, try to find these things that are whipping through our own solar system and attach something to it when it goes by, or figure out when we're going to shoot something off next and try to attach something to that before it gets flung out of the solar system. Because, like, it costs a lot to launch something that's 400 meters across. Like, we're not going to build a space station and send that to another star. But we could build a little something and attach it to something that's 400 meters that is already en route to another star.
Yeah, give it a nuclear power source and a radio beacon,
right,
or something.
And just, like, you know that it's going to be millions and millions of years. But, like, if you can get this little thing onto that rock that is very much big enough to detect by the telescopes the other people have, and they happen to see it, and whatever you rig up on there, I'm not smart enough to know what we would put on there, but I'm just thinking about, like, you know, we always think about, like, shooting radio signals out or shooting a single spacecraft, but a telescope wouldn't pick up a Voyager.
No.
Necessarily. The telescopes we have today, I should say. At some point, we probably will, but, like, the stuff we have today that we're working with could not pick up a Voyager at that distance moving at that speed, but it could pick up a 500-meter rock. Of which we've already established there are a ton of 500-meter rocks flying throughout the universe.
Hmm. It's like an interstellar message in a bottle.
Yeah, kind of, I don't know. It's just like, this is happening a lot. Why don't we take advantage of it?
You did take that somewhere crazy. That's good.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even that crazy, right? It's just like, we obviously, this is not something we could pull off today. But, I don't know. So there's that.
The things we stay up at night thinking about.
Does this particular incident make you concerned about planetary defense at all?
I think there's probably, I'm gonna speculate here, but there's did I just say, yeah,
like driving to work tomorrow is more dangerous?
Well, yes, definitely, for me at least. But like, there's probably more danger in just the garbage spinning around our solar system than there is from some random, like, shooting a 400-meter rock at another star is also a pretty difficult task, right? Like, it's got to be lined up pretty close. That being said, if it does happen, we probably won't notice because it'll just punch a hole right through us at that speed.
Yeah, we didn't see this until it was a week past us. You know, like, we're totally screwed, especially out of the ecliptic. That's like, we weren't looking up.
No.
You know?
Well, and that's always the case with these, like, you read about it or whatever, it just, like, pops up on Twitter, like, asteroid, blah, 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 passed close to Earth at 115,000 kilometers. Everything was fine. And you're like, okay, cool. And then you look at the, like, the name of the asteroid's, like, got a date on it, and it's always, like, 2017, like, a week ago. And you're like, hold on, hold on. You found this a week ago, and now you're just letting me know it's passing by safely. Like, we need a little more notice in that one. The ones that come close to Earth, I want their names to be like 2001 something,
Harry.
Something, something.
No, yeah. Name them. Straight up, yeah. Name them. Like Hurricane.
48P Harry. Like the one that, like, yeah, way back. Those are the ones that I want to come close to us. The other ones, I want to be very, very far away. But that's not how it works, I guess.
Well, I've sufficiently taken us off track.
Mm-hmm. I'll throw one more thing on there. Someone did, you know, there's like the cool animation of like it looping by the sun and does that really hyperbolic orbit. Someone copied that animation and then increased the mass of the thing to the size of a red dwarf star to see what it would do to the solar system. So there's like this,
like rips it apart.
Yeah, there's like this like other sun coming down, and then as soon as it like gets close to our sun, then the gravity is like, it like combines, like, you know, like R4, like Transformers or whatever, and like all the planets are like, and they just like spin off, and like
they just launch.
Jupiter's now inclined like 40 degrees, and like it was not pretty. I think like Earth had like a super elliptical orbit afterwards, so like you were spinning, it was not good.
But
so,
we were still orbiting our sun.
We were, I think. There was one.
Oh, that's kind of awesome.
Something went, I think maybe Mars was gone, like, see you later. But yeah, and then all the orbit inclinations were all wonky.
Man, that would suck for your podcast, dude.
It would, yeah.
Well, that would be the end of that.
That's probably the least of my concerns. I'd probably be more concerned about the new Earth summer where the temperatures reach 500 degrees on the...
Hey, man, Canada would be warm, though. You'd be all right. There's got to be a sci-fi book about that, right?
Maybe, yeah. Well, I mean, they do the ones about Mercury all the time, right? Because Mercury is kind of like that, where it's like hot on one side and it's...
Right, yeah. Mercury, no, I just meant a giant gravity thing floating through.
Maybe.
Because like even... I would like to see that graphic, but with a Jupiter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like a rogue planet, rogue Jupiter, which sounds crazy. I guess just as crazy as a rogue star like that, but
yeah,
you know. Something of that mass that just like launches through, because that would just probably wouldn't be catastrophic, but it would like throw off our orbit enough to make summer weird or do whatever, you know, tip us over a couple more degrees, and then, you know, your 100th meridian is probably a little bit off and beer changes, right? So like there's just like a lot of these little changes that happen over time.
It'd be like runaway greenhouse effect and we'd all die. Probably.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. That seems to be the way that things are going, so.
These systems have been settled for hundreds of millions of years. Can't just tweak it.
Should we do picks?
Picks? yeah, we can do picks. I have a pick.
What's your pick? Oh, wait, no. We got an email.
Oh, we did get an email.
Yeah, we got an email.
We have at least one listener.
I'm just going to say Shane, because I don't know that he wanted us to say his name for sure, but first names are pretty harmless. Pulling up. He tells us that he loves beer and wants us to talk about beer more. Hope we did.
We did that, I think.
A little bit more. I mean, I guess like the only way to do it more is to like review the beer at the end or something. But
10 out of 10 would drink again.
Same. All right. Shane says, I live in Australia and recently the government here has decided to start a space agency. I was wondering what you thought about new space agencies starting up, and can they have a good impact into the science communities, or should the money be spent with more advanced agencies around the world to help existing projects? P.S. The names in contention for Australia's space agencies are Australia Space Agency, just like NASA without the N. Would you say ASA? I don't know. And my favorite, my personal favorite, the Australian Research and Space Exploration. There's got to be a word missing there, right? Because if not, it's arse, and that's, I don't know. I'm into it, but.
Yeah, I don't think they'll go with either one of those. Yeah, I know. That seems like a stretch.
All right, what do you think, though? I feel like ASA would be fine.
Well, I did write down a couple of my own ideas, if you want to hear them.
For names?
Yeah.
Oh, I love it, yeah.
I was thinking about it. Okay, so we could call it, this is for all the Netflix fans out there. This one is the Space Policy of the Upside Down, or SPUD for short.
I like it.
Just like it, and like not.
Yeah, it's not moving me too much off ASA.
Okay. What about the Down Under Management of the Policy of Space?
I like that one a lot. That's good. I like that.
It's dumps for short.
Oh, I would go with that. I would take dumps.
Those are my two ideas.
That's it?
Yeah, just two.
I thought for sure you were gonna have like our moon is the right way up agency for space or something, like you know?
Southern Cross for
Southern Cross forever. Yeah, there it is. So what do you think about specifically the Australian Space Agency, from what little we know about it, and more in general, his question about, do you think it's a good idea for new agencies to start up around the world, or in his hypothetical case, should the money be spent with more advanced agencies? I guess like partnering with a NASA or an ESA or whoever, or doing your own thing.
As a member of a Commonwealth country with its own space agency who is also an associate member of ESA, I have a very topical vantage point, I guess. Yeah. I like it. I like the idea. I think because you need to have that balance, right? You want to do both. I don't think it's an either or. You want to have your own agency so you can pursue national interests. Australia is going to have their own priorities, and you want to have a central place to fund their own scientists, their own engineers, all that kind of stuff. But also be part of ESA and or someone else, right? Like partner up. Get a module. Let's get an Australian module on the space station.
Yeah, totally.
That'd be really cool.
That would be pretty rad.
Yeah.
I like it because, so Australia specifically, they announced at the ISC, and from the announcements we heard, they were saying that at first they're focusing the agency itself on regulatory stuff because there are companies that want to provide services in Australia and they need a point of contact, like just logistical space stuff, space business stuff. And with like the mega constellations that are coming soon and, you know, there's increased activity in the Southern Hemisphere with Rocket Lab and others like that. There's just more activity in general. So,
yeah,
you know, for the sole purpose of having a point of contact, I think it's a good thing. It's like, you know, I think that is a requirement of any country that wants to, you know, interact with those businesses or agencies or anyone that's doing that kind of stuff. But then, like, how far do they take it into the science realm? Like you're saying, I agree with what you're saying, is like, you don't have to immediately start a space agency and then follow the lead of the US and Soviets in the 60s and like India and China are kind of doing, like, build up your own thing. You don't have to do that right off the bat. You can be like the other countries that are in ESA and contribute to these bigger projects, but, you know, provide what you can. And, you know, Canada's got quite the expertise in robotic arms that they will give to any of these projects and provide to any of those things. So you can find a niche. You know, there's going to be plenty more niches here. And as a continent that has quite a bit of desert, you've got really good environment down there to do testing for Mars that we often do, like out on mountains in Hawaii or up in what's that island? Devon Island up north.
Yeah, in the crater.
There's like
right?
and out in Utah, you know, like these environments are typically very useful, and Australia's got quite a bit of it. So, you know, there's always a way to find a niche that I think could contribute to the bigger global projects in a way that would then bring a lot of it back home for people in Australia, and, you know, the whole Inspire Kids and all that kind of stuff comes into it at that point.
Yeah. I mean, it just gets them a seat at the table, right? That's probably one of the most important things when you're having these international collaborations. You got to have some representation. And there's plenty of countries that have space agencies in a similar manner. Like, you think about, you know, DLR in Germany or the UK Space Agency. These are things you don't really hear about that often because they kind of get swallowed up into ESA stuff, but they do their own thing and they represent their own national interests at the table. And that's what you have to get, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And then, you know, you see where it goes from there. If something goes south with Rocket Lab's launch site and they need something else, you're pretty close. You could snatch that up. You're also very primely located for polar orbits down in Australia, which is like, you know, the hotness right now is polar orbits and sun synchronous and all that kind of stuff. So it's the same thing with, like, I always thought the UK would be a really prime location for polar orbit kind of stuff, you know, and turns out they're now trying to get a spaceport up there. So a lot of interesting stuff with, like, the expanse of commercial industry now. And I think that's kind of a thing that people are always saying, like, well, how is this different than the last era of space and space launch and all that kind of stuff? You know, we had these promises 20, 30 years ago. What's different now? But you see so much more activity as people realize that, like, this is an expanding business. This is going... Now, obviously, there are some spaceports in here in the U.S. specifically that put a bad name on opening up any given spaceport, Spaceport America. But, like, because it didn't serve any purpose, you know, a spaceport that's somewhere that can provide access to sun synchronous orbits, you know, for countries that don't have them right now, that's a pretty awesome you know, idea there.
Yeah.
I also like the Australian thing because I feel like in a sense they might feel a little ripped off that they had an orbital launch facility and they used it and then that was it.
Yeah.
I would like to see that, you know, rekindle that.
In, Woomera or whatever, right?
That's yeah, the, totally. Yeah.
I think it's, I think it's a good idea because just like you said, they're, compared to 30, 40 years ago, I mean, today it's almost like anyone and their dog can start a space company now. Like you can just, we're just going to, do a few rounds of investment and we bought some patents on some, CubeSat technology and bam, we're a space company now. And they just need somewhere to set up, right? So like if you want in on that pie, and I think that is a very important pie of business that, governments want their countries to be a part of, then you need a seat at the table. That's it.
Do it. Get yourself a space agency, everybody.
Yeah. Get on it. So, Shane, thanks for writing. Good luck to you and your fledgling space agency.
Yeah. Got some picks now.
Picks.
Let's hear it.
Okay. So, I grabbed this one 2 days ago. That's when it came out, 2 days ago. This is probably going to be how picks happens for a while, is that I just think about the coolest thing I did recently. It'll be a pretty nice feat of planning.
That's kind of the point, but it's all right.
Well, it'll be a pretty nice feat of planning if, like, the pick for next month, like, I get tomorrow. Like, that'll be something pretty remarkable if I plan that far ahead. I'm like, oh, no, this is the one. This is it. But this is just a Planetary Society blog entry, and I'm sorry it's Mars-related. We're going to do some of the stuff that we do regularly.
Yeah, no. I think PIX is okay.
PIX is okay.
That.
Yeah. So this is from the Mastcam Z or Mastcam Z, depending on whether you're listening from America or Australia. So the Mastcam Z team blog, and they're talking about the camera. So Mastcam Z is the stereoscopic camera that is going to go on the mast of the Mars 2020 rover. So it's the upgraded version of Curiosity's Mastcam. Really cool stuff about the camera itself. So it's got zoom lenses and the stereoscopic bits and all this kind of thing.
Does it have portrait mode like my new iPhone?
maybe
it's really good. I hope they put it in there.
So you
keep jokes.
Yeah, really bad. You can read up all about the cool technological stuff, but what really struck me, which is why I made this a pick, is a really cool thing that I didn't know. So Mars's day is 40 minutes longer than Earth. And so if you're working today on a rover like Curiosity or whatever, your shift moves 40 minutes throughout the day. And so sometimes it's nice 9-to-5 shift and sometimes it's like in the middle of the night that you have to work because it takes them, 8-9 hours, whatever is. I think at the beginning it was as long as like 16 hours to plan one solid operation. So they're getting better at it, but they're still down to like a full day. And so that's kind of a pain because it sucks to be on that shift. Basically, it's like the worst shift imaginable, if you think about it. So one of the things they're trying to do with this camera is get it down to a point where they can work a 5-hour shift to plan a single sol. And if you can get it that small, they can, move it just to the end of the day, and then they can actually move it back to the start of the day without having to work the overnight shift. So they can do like, just work 6 a.m. to 11 p.m. is the range that your 8 hours would ever fall in instead of having to do the overnight. So they're like working really hard to get this operational bit down with this camera. And I just thought that was really cool. I think that's a really neat.
That is awesome.
Kind of an operational problem to solve. And I don't know. It struck me. I was like captivated when I started reading about
that. I have this in my reading list. I'm glad I didn't read it yet so I could be sitting here in awe as you described like workflow improvements. Yeah. But it is really cool when you think about like building a rover to have a better workflow and to like actually have sensible sleep patterns and things like that.
Yeah.
It's a pretty cool, like, oh, we've made it. Like we're here now.
Yeah.
This is an operational kind of thing, not just like totally experimental rover on the surface of Mars. We're like considering quality of life, which is kind of awesome.
Exactly. Yeah. So they're thinking they can keep people on the mission longer, cause you probably have turnover because of that. And, I guess nowadays, because it takes so long, every once in a while you get something called a restricted stall. So like the shift just doesn't line up in time for the downlink because that happens at the same time. And so you just miss a stall. Like there's just a stall where the rover just sits there, which is not good for, productivity. So this is really cool.
Yeah, especially on a rover like Curiosity and Mars 2020 that aren't solar power based.
No.
They're not going to have the lifespan that Opportunity does right now. Because Opportunity is just still kicking. Like, that thing is never going to die.
Yeah.
But there is a point in time at which Curiosity cannot drive more.
Yeah. Well, and just think of it purely from a spending tax dollars wisely, right? You're going to get more science for every dollar spent. So that's all good. It's great. So yeah, check it out. It's Planetary Society. And there's some cool stuff about the software and a little bit about the hardware and stuff. So it's a pretty cool blog. They're going to do more apparently, so I really look forward to learning.
Yeah, I always like their focus pieces on those kind of things.
Yeah, they do.
It's like a deep dive.
Yeah,
you've done a lot of those good shows too as well, where you had one show per rover or something this year, right? Like that was your 2017. So.
Yeah, the three generations of rover I tried to do. Yeah.
And those are awesome. So if anyone hasn't heard those yet, read this blog post, then go listen to those because I really enjoyed that stuff. It just brings up stuff like that you'd never thought of.
Yeah. Do you think we have any organic listeners yet? Do you think
that have just discovered I'm saying that, but you're probably right. But somebody in the future,
we should probably assume there's at least one. Then we can.
I don't think that's the case.
No.
But at some point, somebody will, and then they'll go back probably and listen and hear this part. But at that point, maybe they have already went back and listened. I don't know. Doesn't matter. It's a great show.
They're on Apple Podcasts, Space Podcast. Oh, I like beer. Let's try this one out.
Oh yeah, this one with two episodes.
Who are
two
they?
Widely spaced episodes?
Yeah. Who are these assholes? I'm not listening to this anymore. Delete.
And then they'll find. Yeah, they won't listen to our other shows at this.
Please stay with us. We are okay. It's not as bad as it seems.
I've got a pick as well, and I've got a pick that is both somewhat timely, and I'm wearing a shirt for it right now.
Hey,
wearing my Centaur shirt.
That shirt,
because I knew
familiar.
I was going to talk about this. So a couple of weeks ago, was it a couple weeks? A couple weeks, maybe 2 weeks or so ago, there was this announcement that United Launch Alliance was going to upgrade Centaur to fly on their first launch of their new Vulcan launch vehicle in the 2020. So they're going to go to Centaur 5, and it's got all these new updates. It's going to be kind of awesome. We don't know a lot of details yet, but that made me think about a book that I finished up a couple of months ago, I guess I would say. It's called Taming Liquid Hydrogen, the Centaur Upper Stage Rocket, 1958 to 2002. This is one of those NASA history collection books or whatever. There's a free PDF on NASA.gov. I'll put a link in the show notes. It's also available on iBooks for $8 or something like that, which I did because it's got a lot of fancy drawings and I like reading it better as an ebook. There's no Kindle version, which is kind of weird, but because there's a lot of drawings, I'm okay with that. Whatever. Links in the show notes for it. It's written by Virginia P. Dawson and Mark D. Bowles. Bowles, I'm going to say. It's just the history of Centaur all the way up to 2002. So it starts with the early days with Centaur designer Kraft Eric and the father of Atlas, Charlie Bossart. Bossart? I don't know. Crazy names. But it starts from way back, 50s, and the debate between balloon tanks versus more structural kind of tanks like Saturn used. So it talks a lot about how when they were working on the Saturn program, there was this whole fight between Von Braun and the balloon tank contingent that said, balloon tanks are where it's at. There's all these advantages. And Von Braun was very much on the kind of old-minded train. And there was this, push and pull, and then this whole time they're working on RL-10 with no hyphen, much to everyone's dismay, no hyphen in the engine name. And then it turns out RL-10 was used on one of the stages of Saturn, which was a big boon for Centaur itself because they finally had to work through all these different liquid hydrogen issues in the early days. And it just goes through the whole history. It's awesome. They go through Surveyor and Mariner and Pioneer, Shuttle Centaur, Titan Centaur. They just talk through all of these different crazy projects that the thing has been involved in. And, I kind of consider Centaur the Millennium Falcon of spacecraft that we have today. it's like this just, it ain't pretty, but it's got it where it counts kind of thing, where it's just it's sent something to every planet and a bunch of minor bodies. And it's done so much. And obviously every version has changed quite a bit. And that's going to be the same thing with Centaur 5. But when you read this book, you get a sense for the heritage that it has and how it came to be, why it is how it is today. How it is today is drastically different than how it was when it began life, but you can see the steps that it took to get where it is today. And then you, like, the Shuttle Centaur stuff alone is kind of amazing to read as well. You know, I wasn't alive for that stuff. But it was a huge, huge project that was literally one launch away from going.
Yeah, I remember reading about
Challenger happened.
Shuttle Centaur, and it was, like, very contentious, right? Because it was like you're pressurizing a bunch of hydrogen and sticking it in the bay of the shuttle, right?
Yeah, I mean, and then the other side is saying, yeah, you're sticking it in the bay of the shuttle that is already like a horribly designed thing in terms of safety. So yeah. There's a little bit of playing both sides there, you know, like, so hydrogen's okay on that side, hydrogen is not okay on this side. Yeah, I don't really get that.
It's the heat shield tiles, you know.
Oh, is that what it is? Yeah. Okay. Shuttle Centaur, that section is cool because you see how much work went into it, and it was like getting ready to launch. You know, the same deal with the West Coast launch pad from Shuttle. There was one getting prepared to launch from West Coast when Challenger happened, and there was a Shuttle Centaur mission on the books, but it collapsed, and that kind of like, you know, it changed a lot of things in Centaur's legacy. And there's still a Shuttle Centaur, I think it's at NASA Glenn now. That it's still like sitting out there on display.
Oh, I'd love to see that.
Which is pretty cool.
Wasn't that was Galileo was going to fly on that, wasn't it?
Galileo, yeah. And Ulysses, I think.
Yeah. And they were going to put on that. And Shuttle Centaur had the power to just like send it straight there. But then they're like, no, we got to take it off. So then I had to do like this like really circuitous multiple gravity system.
Cause and they had to use the inertial upper stage.
Yeah. IUS, yeah.
There's a great Space Review article about Galileo from years ago. I'll find this link. About that whole thing, how it was like planned to take this one route and then it kind of got shelved for a while, and eventually that led to the issue with its antenna. So it's just a crazy story.
Because
Galileo
in storage for like however many years,
like
through
5 years or something,
so that the like lubricant on the
so that's nuts. But yeah, the Centaur book itself is very interesting. If you're into that kind of like hardware stuff, I find it very interesting. I love Centaur as much as people will give it flack for all different things. And obviously everything has drawbacks and gravity losses, yada, yada. But when you read that book and you see how much history is on that one stage, it's kind of amazing. And like I said, it's just cool to see like each decision of each era building onto the next. And it, you know, if you look at Centaur today and look at the first Centaur that flew, they're nothing alike other than they use similar shapes and similar components and things like that. But to get from there to here is a really cool story and worth reading if you're interested in that kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, we don't have a lot of space hardware that has that, I mean, that clear evolution over that
lineage,
long a time scale, right? Like almost everything flying today is different in a big sense, but that's like one of the more common components. Yeah. It's a good story. Okay. I'm looking forward to reading that now.
Yeah. It's pretty awesome. What else do we got? You had in our notes that we didn't plug anything last time, but then also 5 minutes ago, you were giving me shit because you're saying that nobody listens to this that hasn't listened to this.
That's what I was saying, is that like, I think it's fine for episode one, but maybe we should like starting episode two, just presume there's like one person, like the one, to the one person out there who like just took a chance on this in Apple Podcasts or whatever. Here's who we are. do you want to introduce yourself first?
Oh, I was going to make you introduce me and me introduce you.
Oh, because then you can say nice things about the other person without sounding...
I would just be interested in hearing what you had to say.
Okay, so the other guy is Anthony Colangelo. He's the host of the Main Engine Cutoff podcast. So if you like rockets and you like space policy and you like how those work together and current events, what am I missing here? That's kind of a good...
No, you got it, basically.
Yeah. So Anthony does a great job of breaking complicated stuff down, so that's why I found his podcast and fell in love with it, and you should check it out.
And Jake over there, Jake Robbins up in Canada, does a podcast called We Martians, and it's exactly what it sounds like. It's everything about Mars that you would ever want to know. Like I said, it had some great episodes this year on the rovers, specifically talking with people that work on them currently from all different aspects. Gets, you know, both the big picture of Mars, kind of like where we're at with Mars today, both robotic exploration and sending humans there, but also gets super into the details of specific rovers or specific hardware that they're working on for habitats on Mars, or, you know, what other cool projects have you covered that I'm not thinking of right now?
Habitat stuff, like the human analogs. I like
human analogs. Like, oh yeah, you had that awesome episode with the High Seas crew.
Yeah,
that was High Seas Four. Talked with all the people that were in High Seas 4 about what it was like to be on that mission. It's awesome. Go check it out. We Martians in your podcatcher, wherever you're listening to this.
Mm-hmm.
Random Apple podcast stray listener.
Thank you, one person.
If that's you, please email us.
Yeah. Yeah. Let us know.
It's Shane. It's Shane. Shane was the one.
I don't think it's Shane.
No.
There's no way it's Shane. But if it is.
I actually know factually it is not Shane.
Oh. Oh, right. Because he said in the email, he's like.
He said, yeah. That,
he's
yeah.
like, I like.
I listen to your other things.
I like space podcasts and beer. So this is perfect.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's not Shane.
It's not Shane. Okay.
But we do love you, Shane.
We do love Shane. He listens to three of our podcasts. So. It's really, we couldn't ask for much more.
No.
Okay, that's it. I think
that was off nominal.
That's off nominal two, part de.
Oh, put that song in. Put the.
Yeah, so you're gonna fade out to the. Well, I might as well just play 100th Meridian.
Play us out. Would you play us out?
I'll play us out. This is.
That's a Bill O'Reilly. We'll do it live.
Oh, brutal.
What does that mean to play us out?
I don't know.
Oh, you never see that?
No. I'm not awesome. Actually it's in funny. Radio.
It's funny. That's actually TV and it's America. Do you have them up there? I don't know. Sounds like you don't.
I don't know. Everyone up here is so mild-mannered. I can't remember anybody. You know?
Anyway, tell us what we're listening to.
You're listening to The 100th Meridian by The Tragically Hip. So rest in peace, Gord Downie. We'll miss you. And thanks for listening. Where the great plains begin. At the 100th Meridian. At the 100th Meridian. Where the great plains begin. Driving down a corduroy road. Weeds standing shoulder high.